5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
That guy from Austria that got married, has two daughters, and then exploited them. I'm hoping he's doing the rest of his life in prison.
He is, yeah. He got convicted, his case adjudicated. Victims were rescued, taken away from him, a place with their biological mother. I think he was 62 years old when he was arrested, and he got just over like 65 years in prison. So he'll die there. I was with him during the arrest, and he was, you know, kind of a healthy guy. He had some weight on him. He's about my size. Then I saw him at his first court appearance about a year later, and he looked like a POW. He came walking out in orange and shackles, and that was my punch in the nose to him when he came in and then got sentenced to 65 years.
Came out looking like a bag of bones.
Yeah, absolutely like a bag of bones. It'd been a rough year, and now he's got, you know, 65 more to go.
Hey, everybody. Why did you come back? Because you love me. That's why you came back. Welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. You probably noticed I don't have my headset on today and I don't have a microphone in front of my face. We had a little technical issues. I think it was probably on my end because Murphy's Law, if anything can go wrong, you know it's going to. We'll just see how the podcast goes because it might be a few more things. But you'll understand a little bit more about that after I introduce our guest to you. I want to remind you that January is National Human Trafficking Awareness Month. And if you, three episodes ago, the first episode of 2025 here on Game of Crimes was with Tyler Schwab, who runs Libertas International down in Colombia. That's the second time I've had him on the show. That's an organization that I support now. I will continue to support as long as I can. But, and I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but our guest today is also involved in that work. And I'll tell you more about it once we get to that part in the show. But right now, what I want to do is welcome Chad Melly to our podcast today. Chad, welcome, brother. Good to have you on the show.
Hey, Steve, thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, people say that at the beginning and afterwards, they never call me back.
I'll call you back, I promise.
We're going to have some fun today, but we're also going to get into some very serious topics here. I just want to do everything I can. Let me tell you, Game of Crimes will do everything it can to fight human trafficking as long as I've got the show, and I have no intentions of going anywhere for a long time. So, we'll get into that here in just a few minutes. I will make this one statement now because I want you to know how I feel. I've said this in other interviews. Anyone who would enslave another human being, especially children, is the lowest form of life in Murph's book. People say, what's the lowest thing in the world? That's whale shit on the bottom of the ocean. These people are lower than that. Mm-hmm. All right.
I agree.
I think about it. And I think I've got an ally here with me today.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, seriously, I hope you believe the same thing because, I mean, this is some depraved, perverted, sick minds, people that just, I don't know that they even qualify to be called people when they want to take advantage of others, like what goes on. Chad, I'm getting on a little soapbox here early today. It seems to happen when we have this these topics on here. But so listen, everybody, we always start the show with a small town police blotter. We're going to do the same today because we need a little laugh to get this thing going. And you know, the disclaimer has got to come up. This is a show about crime. We talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, we do take our show serious, as you'll find out, but we're never going to miss the opportunity to have a little laugh at the expense of some of these stupid criminals that are out there. Believe me, there's no shortage of them. I hit Chad with that. He's actually on the other side of the world. He's in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. So when I sent him an email, I guess it was before you went to bed last night, right?
It was. Yep, it was.
So we're recording this on a Sunday night, East Coast time, and it's Monday morning over where he is.
That's right.
For this redneck hillbilly trying to figure out what the time frames are, let me tell you, if I look a little flustered, you'll know why, because the water appears muddy down there. Chad is originally a police officer in Arkansas, and we'll talk more about that also, but we found a funny story from Arkansas. And this will be the first one we've ever had from Arkansas, Chad. So take it away, brother.
Well, and it's great because this is, I know this area well, Jonesboro Police Department. A few years ago, I worked for the Attorney General's office. At that time, the Attorney General was a former police officer. He started out at the Jonesboro Police Department. So we spent a lot of time up there because he had family up there. But this is an interesting case here. I'll read it for you. A man already facing an indecent exposure charge allegedly pulled his pants down to his ankles, burst into an Arkansas courtroom where he announced to the judge and everybody there, "Court is back in session." Now, this is detailed by the Jonesboro Police Department. Derek Thomas, 18, was hit with obviously several new charges related to that behavior. He'd been in custody since his arrest for, they found him lying naked on a Jonesboro sidewalk. That's what he was originally arrested for. So he was in court on that charge when an officer allowed him to get a drink from the bathroom sink adjacent to one of the holding cells. As the officer was dealing with another inmate, Thomas emerged from the bathroom, pulled his pants down again, took his ankle to his ankles, took his shirt off, ran back in and screamed, as we said, "Court is in session." As they were dragging him away, he mentioned to one of the other inmates, he said, "I told you I'd do it." And he said, "They'll put that on my tombstone, that I was the one naked in the courtroom." So I guess that's his claim to fame, or that's what he's always wanted, for that to be his claim to fame. Interesting. You know,
that's one of the best stories we've had on here, the fact that you were aware of it.
That's nuts.
I got to say, I was a cop for 38 years. I never saw anybody come in court with their pants down and their shirt off.
Yeah, no, I never have either. Not in court.
What's it say about our youth today? Not anything real good, does it?
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
Oh, that's hilarious. All right, let's see if we can get this other one up here. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm right back in Florida here because I live in Orlando, and I never run out of stories to talk about Florida. And this is the way the story starts out. In a story so Florida, it hurts.
That says a lot right there.
That says it all, doesn't it? Yeah. A woman was arrested after allegedly leaving her two small children alone in a hot car that had a bag of methamphetamine on the front seat while she shopped at a Dollar Tree store. Now, I don't like that last part because I shop at Dollar Tree. You know, I don't want to bring a bad name on that business, but that's where she was. Investigators allege that Nicole Buffington, who was 24 years old at the time, left the minors in the vehicle for nearly 30 minutes. Now, this is Florida. It gets warm here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Police responding to a 911 call found the children, a 7-year-old boy and a 1-year-old girl. Cops also discovered a bag containing a crystalline substance on top of the clutter on the driver's seat. Field tests revealed that the substance contained meth. Buffington was subsequently contacted inside a nearby Dollar Tree store and arrested on child neglect and narcotics possession charges. She was booked into the Pasco County Jail, where she remained locked up on a $10,000 bond. According to her Facebook page, she works at McDonald's, but the cops have her listed as unemployed. Her rap sheet includes multiple arrests for narcotics possession and possession of drug paraphernalia, some people just never learn, as well as collars for theft and failure to appear in court. Now, Chad, you don't know this yet because, you know, we're just now getting acquainted and getting started here, but we have the number one rule on the game of crimes is kids don't do meth.
Yeah.
All right. So she's never listened to the show.
Yeah, obviously.
I'll tell you what, man. I did an interview a couple of days ago, and I told our guest on there that I think you could add the other 49 states together, and Florida would still have more stupid criminals than all the other states combined.
Yeah. I always look for those headlines in the paper, Florida man did this, Florida man did that.
I never heard that. I lived here. My first post with DEA was in Miami back in the 80s. And then we moved to Orlando a few years ago. And I had never heard of Florida man until I got back down here. But
really?
Fully aware of him now.
I'm sure.
Yeah. I mentioned to you folks here earlier about how Chad and I met, and had Tyler Schwab twice on the show now, and 6 months from now, I'll probably have him on again just to update us on everything. If you remember, his most recent was episode 178, which was on January 6th of 2025, so just 3 weeks ago. He's the founder and the CEO of Libertas International down in Medellin, Colombia. That does not confine them to Colombia. And if you have listened to his last podcast, go back and listen to it, please. Because he's now in the States because of the death threats he's under down in Colombia. You know, the U.S. Homeland Security investigators, HSI, in conjunction with the Colombian National Police, work with Tyler and his organization. And both of them said, you got to go back to the States for a while. You know, we can't protect you. We can't protect your life. So that's where he is. But as I mentioned on other shows also, I'm going to take this human trafficking thing as serious as I can. I'm sure Chad's going to tell some stories today, and you might see me tear up. And if you've seen my past shows, it's not the first time. Stories about children being abused just break my heart. But just to remind you, we had episode 28. Now, just so you know, Chad's episode is 181. So we've been doing this for almost since we started the show, back when Morgan was still with me. Episode 28, we had Tricia Cannon, who was the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, talking about the cases she's working on. The very next episode, 29, we had Sherry Foster on, one of my best friends, like a sister to me. She was GBI, and then she did a career with DEA. She now works for the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Georgia. She talks about what she did. We had a victim on here in episode 60, Natasha Herzig, who was kidnapped. I think she was 19 years old, I believe, San Jose, California. Wow. She told us her story, and you saw how devastating that was to her and how her life changed because of those events. On episode 113, we brought Ty Holland on, who was a former Seattle police officer who worked for an anti-human trafficking organization and continues to do so to this day. Episode 145, we had Seth Griffith on, who was an Air Force Tactical Air Control officer, 7 tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, stud. Wow. He is now with Aerial Recovery. And you know what? Right today, we are recording this on January 12th. He's out in California with Aerial Recovery. Helping the folks in LA during all the fire devastation that's going out there. I mean, and his organization also helps to rescue victims of child exploitation. And then episode 146, we had Heidi Chance on, who's retired Phoenix PD. She did cybercrime with Phoenix PD, and she continues in retirement teaching others about it. A lot about like what Chad's going to talk about today. So that was a lot of talking there. I guess my point, though, is that's how serious the problem is, and we want to take it serious. You know, for Chad to give up his time on the other side of the world to spend, you know, a couple hours with us talking about what he does and what we can do, you know, it's not his problem. It's not their problem. It's our problem. Speaks to the dedication of some of the folks that are involved in this, like Chad and his organizations. What we usually do is we want to find out a little bit more about you because I've been talking since we started. Here we are. We're almost 12 minutes into the show and you haven't said hardly anything. But if you would, tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, what your family was like, going to school, let's say.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, all my law enforcement career was in Arkansas. Prior to that, I was born in Michigan, Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It calls Upers up there. Very small town, Nagani, Michigan, population probably 2,000, 3,000, but it was wonderful. You know, there's a lot of hunting. It's a beautiful area up there, northern Michigan. I have an older brother, a younger sister, so I'm the middle child, dealt with that. But you know, fantastic upbringing. And then ended up joining the military, the Arkansas National Guard. My family relocated from Michigan to Arkansas around my eighth grade year, just for work. So that got me to Arkansas, went to high school there. And then after high school, joined the National Guard, did 6 years in the Guard, and then decided I was out of the military. I was out of high school. My parents, my family, everybody had relocated back to Michigan. We had moved quite a bit when I was younger, just different jobs for my parents. And I was, you know, I was a bit tired of that. So I said, no, I'm done moving. I'm staying in Arkansas. And I always wanted to be a police officer. I looked up to officers back in the early 90s. Cops was all over TV. It was really exciting. I thought, that's what I'm going to do. And joined the police academy in Arkansas in 96.
90?
Yeah. 1996. I was, I think, 22 years old and went straight in. And I've been involved in law enforcement since then, up until I left back in 2018.
Well, I guess I'm going to tell you how old I am here because I'd already been in the police department for a year when you were born.
Shit. Well, you don't look that old.
Yeah, thank you. I'll send you a check. You have a Zelle account.
Yeah.
I was like that too. I mean, since I can remember as a little bitty tyke. And yeah. Had my first run-in with the cops at 10 years old trying to break in a house. And I was impressed with them at a very young age. And yeah. Led to a 38-year career. So it's encouraging to have somebody else on here that was like me, that's all they ever wanted to do.
Yeah, it's just something I always wanted to do. I always looked up to, police officers, and just thought it'd be a great, great career path. And 22 years, just over 21 years, full-time sworn, and I loved every minute of it.
Yeah. What did your mom and dad do?
I was actually my mom and stepdad. My parents got divorced. I was really, really young. He was in the aerospace industry. They worked at a corporation where they built the fiberglass areas around the cowl of a jet. Was involved in that. Was a plant manager for one of those big companies, and they just happened to open a new plant in Arkansas. Never been to Arkansas, never wanted to move to Arkansas, and found myself in eighth grade all of a sudden landing in Arkansas, which was a bit of a pain for me.
I'm with you, brother. When I was going in eighth grade, we moved from Tennessee to West Virginia, and the kids in West Virginia with their hillbilly accents thought I had an accent because I was from Tennessee, and I did. Yeah. I'm thinking, have you guys heard yourself talk?
I still get it. I can talk to jump on the phone and talk to my mom or my brother for 20 minutes, and as soon as I hang up, and then it starts coming back, I'll start talking about.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it comes out.
It's the same way with me. If my sister passed away last year, but when I'd go to visit her, she still lived down in Murfreesboro, just south of Nashville. And if I was on the phone with her, or if we went down there within a couple hours, it was night and it was light and, sunshine.
Yeah. Light. It comes back really quick.
Your brother and sister, they have anything to do with law enforcement?
My brother just recently retired. He was in corrections. So he was worked at a prison guard, ended up being a security director. He relocated. He started in Arkansas just as a corrections officer, and then eventually migrated back to up north. He went as far as to Wisconsin. And then spent all of his career there in Wisconsin at a couple of different prisons. And again, just recently retired. My sister, no, she's just normal jobs, just regular mm-hmm. civilian. So just me and my brother are the only two. And it's funny because nobody prior to us in our family had been in law enforcement. Everybody, where we were from up north in Michigan, worked in the iron ore mines. And, the first discovery of iron ore was actually in the small town I'm from, Nagani, Michigan. Iron ore mines, that's where you work. If you're from up there, that's what you do.
My cousins and I, we were the first generation non-coal miners from West Virginia. I would not go down in that hole for anything. I could work the surface, but not in that hole.
Yeah, but by the time my dad got into iron ore mines, they were open pit mines, or they had finally quit the underground mines up there. They're just huge open pit mines, and they're still going today. But every time I go up there, I have to drive by one because it's just to see how much earth they move on a daily basis. It's just amazing.
Yeah. It really is. It really is. Yes,
and it's hard work. It's hardworking people up there.
It is. Yeah, the miners, take my hats off to them. That's work that will kill you.
That's right.
So when you were in high school, did you play any sports?
I did. I played quite a few of them poorly, football and basketball. So there was no scholarship offers when I graduated, but I had fun. But always very active. I found I kind of gravitated towards sports and coaches. And I always listened much better to my coaches than I did my teachers. So it probably kept me out of a lot of trouble.
True. I understand. Why did you want to go into the National Guard? Is that a sense of service to the country, or what was the reason?
Yeah, I wish I could say that. There was a little bit of that. I'm a very patriotic person. At the time I just graduated high school, my family, as I mentioned, they were going to move back up to Michigan. And by that time, finally just turning 18, and I was tired of moving, and I had no means to support myself to stay in Arkansas, but I made the decision I wasn't going. So I joined the military just to get a paycheck. I needed the discipline for sure. After going through 8-week boot camp, because even for the National Guard, it's the same boot camp as the regular Army. It's just after boot camp, you go back home rather than getting immediately deployed to a full time base. But after doing that 8-week, I was convinced, and I still am, that everybody should go through boot camp. It should be mandatory just to learn that respect. And I needed it, boy. I needed it bad. And I think it still helps me even today. I think back to the discipline and the things that I went through during those 8 weeks. It was great.
Yeah, talk to employers, especially especially, you know, big corporations, they want to hire former military folks because they have discipline, they have respect, they know how to get a job done, they know how to focus on a mission, that type of thing. So, and I love the fact that our veterans get preferential treatment, at least in the government. I don't know if they do in private sector, but at that point system. So that helps them out too to get a job. I like that.
And when I first went in, I was interested in being an MP. I mentioned I always wanted to be a police officer. I thought, well, what better position within the Army than to be an MP? Just the unit that I was trying to get into, there wasn't an opening at the time. And I stayed in for 6 years hoping to be able to kind of transfer into the MPs. And it was getting close, but I hadn't yet. And then there was an opening to test at my first agency in Arkansas. So it was like either extend in the military or get out and go full-time into law enforcement. And I'm glad I made the decision that I did because I left in good standing and then went straight into law enforcement. I went to the academy just a few months after getting back.
What was your job in the Guard?
I was a 63 Bravo, which is just like a mechanic.
On just regular vehicles or tanks?
No, just regular vehicles. Deuce and a half, 5 tons, Humvees. Gotcha. Nothing exciting. And I did my boot camp and my advanced training in Columbia, in South Carolina, or Jackson.
Nice and cool down there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Being from the South, that and the bugs, you know, holy cow.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's, you served your country, 6 years service there. So thank you for your service.
Well, thank you. Yes.
We have a nephew. It's actually my wife's niece, her husband. And his first name's Dusty. I'll go past that, but he's the senior NCO. He's a command sergeant major for the National Guard in West Virginia.
Okay. Awesome.
Senior NCO in the whole state, which somehow gives him some jurisdiction over the Air Force Guard as well in West Virginia. I don't understand how that all works, but think the world of him. Just proud of, you know, very, very proud of his service, just like you. So your first police department, where'd you go?
Heber Springs Police Department. It's about an hour north of Little Rock. Kind of a seasonal location, a recreational area, huge Corps of Engineers lake, and a lot of hunting, a lot of camping, big area. Went to the police academy. I think it was 12 weeks at the time, and then came back and started out patrol, working traffic, speeding tickets, and domestic calls, and just kind of worked my way up into investigations.
Yeah. How many sworn officers did they have?
Not very many, probably 15. When I left, it was a pretty small agency. And then our next agency after that was the Arkansas Attorney General's Office, which was pretty big, 180 employees. Not so many licensed, certified law enforcement officers. Most of them were attorneys and prosecutors and special prosecutors. But that was quite a difference, going from 15 officers to downtown Little Rock. It was great.
Yeah. Did you tell me you had a contract job in there?
Yeah, right in between there. Right when I left Heber, I'd gotten a taste of the military. I did my 6 years. I always wanted to deploy and go overseas. And I never got that opportunity during my 6 years. It was right after the Gulf War, missed that. But I always wanted to. And I finally got an opportunity after having 12 years as a full-time police officer. I went over as a civilian contractor to Afghanistan. I did a year and a half over there with DynCorp as like a... a law enforcement mentor, where we were mentoring, kind of training Afghan National Police and Afghan National Army. So I did a year and a half over there, which was just kind of a break in my law enforcement service. And when I came back, I went straight to the Attorney General's office.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Were you in Kabul?
Yes, our main base was there. And then I spent the majority of my time in Paktika, which is kind of a southeast area of Afghanistan, right on the Pakistani border.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful place, huh?
Yeah, it was great. And it was a very unique job. We would go in with the military, obviously, because there's only a couple of us mentors. We would partner up with an army police mentoring team. We would go in and take over an entire district. Mm-hmm. Take all of their law enforcement out. We would take them to Jalalabad and we'd put them through a police academy. And then we would stay with them during the entire academy. Then once they graduated, we would take them back to their district. We would live with them, go out on patrols with them and kind of implement the things that we trained them on and show them how to do patrols. And military would show them military tactics. We'd show them some law enforcement tactics. It was a wonderful opportunity. I never really traveled that much. Now I travel too much, but it was kind of my first introduction into international travel. It was quite an experience.
Yeah. When I was still with DEA, I did a 2-week TDY to Afghanistan, and we landed at the DEA base there in Kabul, but we went to Bagram, Jalalabad, Kunduz, and Kandahar.
Okay.
And so I came back and then a few years later retired, and a friend of mine owns a contracting company in the DC area. He called and offered me a job to go over and be the mentor to the head of the Afghani intelligence agency.
Oh, wow.
And with the money, it was unbelievable. It was a one-year assignment. You got two R&Rs and one home leave or something like that in a year. And it was very attractive financially. I'm thinking about it. I called him back and I said, brother, I tell you what, man, I've been to Afghanistan once. I didn't leave anything over there. Reason for me to go back. Thank you, but no, thank you.
Yeah. I was there for a year and a half. And at the time I had married and had a couple of young kids. And had I not had the kids or the marriage at the time, I probably would have stayed. But it was tough being away. But you mentioned Bagram. We were, when we would be in Kabul, we would make up a reason to go to Bagram. We would go in and somebody has to get something signed or something just so we could do a one-day trip to Bagram just to hit Popeyes.
I thought you were going to say the PX.
No, Popeyes. They had a Popeyes chicken there. And, you only eat so many MREs and goat meat. So whenever we got a chance for Popeyes, we'd make up some reason to go. I can't believe we didn't get blown up just trying to go to Popeyes, but we're lucky we never did.
No, when you're in these dangerous situations, you kind of get used to it. And
it's amazing what you can get used to and get comfortable with. It really is.
And then you don't want to get complacent. That's where the danger part comes in.
Yeah, you're right.
So you came back from the contract job. Did you already have the attorney general's job lined up then?
I had applied for it and I got narrowed down to shortlist. Came in on my final break and got it right away. Yeah, it was kind of in the works as I was wrapping up that contract. I did 1 year, a 6-month extension. And I had it open where I was coming back from my final interview. If that didn't happen, I was going to extend. They hired me. I was the first hire for their new cyber crimes division. Prior to that, the Arkansas Attorney General's office didn't have a cyber crimes division. They didn't really even have a law enforcement leg. The Attorney General is the highest ranking law enforcement official in the state of Arkansas, but they had no sworn staff. So they created that unit. I was one of the first they hired, and I was put on. At first, it was dual service. We'd do part-time executive protection for the Attorney General, not 24-hour full-time, just when he was at major events, and then kind of part-time duty on cyber crimes. So I kind of went back and forth, was dual trained, but once I got exposure to cyber crimes, I had no idea that was something, number one, I would be good at, or number two, that I would really be interested in, but both came true and was off and running after that.
So you had no background in cyber whatsoever, huh?
No, I was always a bit savvy on the computer, but no formal training. I didn't go to university. All my digital forensics training, I am trained for digital forensics now on a lot of tools, on phones and hard drives. All of my training is through law enforcement, none of it through college or university.
Can you program a VCR?
No, probably not.
Me neither. I have to get my grandkids to do that. So before we delve into that, you spent about 6 years there with the Attorney General's office, and then you moved over to another agency, right?
Yeah, right next door, adjoining county. So Little Rock is Pulaski County. Obviously, when I was at the AG's, I had statewide jurisdiction. The Attorney General, who I was very close with and who had initially hired me, his term ended. A new AG came in. They switched from Democrat to Republican, and it was a political office. So you know how that goes. So I left there and just went right next door to Faulkner County. It's a neighboring county, Pulaski County. And I was straight to the major crimes unit, and they allowed me to continue doing just cyber crime. That was my whole goal. Was all I did was cyber crimes, crimes against children, you know, ICAT type crimes, internet crimes against children, online exploitation, trafficking, peer to peer, CFAM cases.
Oh man, how long were you there before you left?
Sheriff's office, I think 4 years, and then I left. So at the end of my 4 years at Faulkner County, I'd been in law enforcement full time at that point, a little over 20 years. And I got an opportunity to leave and continue the work as a civilian for an NGO in Southeast Asia. And I thought it over. It's a tough decision. I was getting to the point where I think I was getting close to burnout because I did have other cases on top of my cyber crimes duty. And I was an on-call investigator. So I also had homicides and stabbings and other cases to work, which makes it really difficult. So I made the decision, you know what? I like the work, and there's no, I don't want to say better place to work these types of cases. It's not better to work these types of cases anywhere, but I found myself from Faulkner County, Arkansas, working these internet crimes against children cases to living in downtown Bangkok, working cases all over Southeast Asia. And I've been doing that for the last 7 years.
Does your wife move with you?
No, I'm divorced, single now. So yeah, it's just me. My kids are older now. My son is 19. My daughter's 25. My daughter's in Northwest Arkansas. My son is in university in Central Arkansas. So they come over quite a bit, spend some time with me on their summer breaks when they're available.
That's pretty exotic place to visit.
It is. My son, the first time he ever flew internationally was from the U.S. to, I think I met him in, or I flew over with him. I just wore him out. He was with me for about 2 months. And I think we hit 11 countries in 2 months. Just all in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
It's great. I travel. I go through a passport about every 3 years or run out of pages.
Wow. Yeah. So just for our listeners, where are you sitting at right now as we're doing this interview?
Yeah. So I'm downtown Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. It's a great location to be based. I'm about a 2-hour flight from Bangkok, 1-hour flight from Cambodia, 2-hour flight from to Indonesia. These are all countries that I kind of cover and I stay active in.
Me. From small town, was it Hebert Springs?
Arkansas,
to living in Southeast Asia. What a change. When you started with the Attorney General's office and their cyber crime, they got you the training. What was your primary crime at that time?
Most of it was online exploitation, traveler cases, people that were online. It was kind of dual. There were a lot of cases of people that were obtaining CSAM. CSAM is child sexual abuse material. So people that were going online, finding that type of content and then viewing it and sharing it with other people. About half of my cases were those type of cases. The other were people that were adults, pedophiles, offenders that were online, grooming and manipulating children, and then maybe pretending to be underage and then getting them at a location and sexually abusing them. Undercover, I would have accounts where I was a 12-year-old boy or a 12-year-old girl.
Was Arkansas a target state for these perverts to focus in on?
No, but I will tell you, Steve, I travel all over the world doing training, speaking with law enforcement, speaking to government. I've been all over the Middle East. I've been all over Africa. I've been in South America, Latin America, speaking to law enforcement. Every time I go somewhere to do training or speak, I look online. There's certain areas, there's certain websites, there's certain places that you look where these offenders kind of hang out, and nobody's immune. I've never landed somewhere not been able to jump online and find people that are looking for children or other people to exploit and abuse. So I think everywhere it has a potential.
Do you have to go on the dark web to find that, or is that on regular internet?
No, that's on Facebook. That's on Instagram. It's on the World Wide Web. 99.9% of my cases are just the regular web or social media.
Well, we've learned through from Tyler that I guess the United States leads the world in perverts.
That doesn't surprise me.
We're already the number one country in the consumer country in the world for consumption of illegal narcotics. And now we got this reputation. Just things that we're really proud of in our country, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning, when we're talking about these kids, and this happened with Tyler, he was telling us a story about this little 19-month-old girl when her mom was doing to her and pimping her out and so forth. And I had to stop the podcast because I teared up. And this is going to sound like a really stupid question because I know it's got to have some kind of emotional or psychological effect on you. How do you deal with something like that?
Yeah, it's probably the number one question I get. And, you know, I've always done fairly well dealing with it. On the CSAN, which is looking at the images and the videos, because I do a lot of digital forensics. So after somebody's arrested, I work with law enforcement. I train law enforcement on going through their phone and finding deleted images and deleted files. It's always been very mechanical for me. You know, I've seen so much CSAM that I've seen it all. Nothing surprises me to date, but it's very mechanical for me. I'm looking for certain things. If it's an image, it's a bad image, that instant shock, it's short-lived for me. Then after that, it's what am I looking at that could help identify this person, this victim, or this offender to get them arrested? I'm looking at the outlets in the background. Are those U.S. plugs? Are those Asia plugs? Are those European plugs? Is there or something on the background that has writing on it? Is it English? What language is it in? Is it written in? Forensically, there's things contained in digital images like GPS, camera makes the model. I'm putting that puzzle together. So the CSAM, that initial horrific image, again, it's very short-lived for me, and I'm, you know, working other things. On the exploitation cases, like the one Tyler mentioned, I've learned to take small victories. Work that case, stop that abuse, get that offender in court, get them arrested, get that victim rescued, and get them the services that they need. And then for me, it's on to the next one. That's a victory for me. I'm not trained to communicate with victims. I'm not on our survivor or aftercare team. That's somebody else's job. Just on to the next one. I don't kind of dwell on that for a very specific reason. I want to just take that as a win and go on with that.
Tyler, after we did his interview earlier this month, introduced me to one of the victims that was fortunate to be rescued and has her life under control now and is doing well. Actually, I'm talking to her about becoming the editor for a Game of Crimes podcast.
Oh, that's amazing.
We communicate not on Facebook. What is it? She introduced me to Telegram. This little fart, I never heard of Telegram. So she sent me the link and I got it set up and everything. And she's working on an episode right now for me, just see how things are going to work out. But she's from Medellin, Colombia, is where she was having her problems. And you don't know this, but my two daughters we were stationed in Colombia for 3 years. And both my daughters are Colombian by birth. We adopted them down there. And one of them's from Medellin. Mm-hmm. Just a special place for my wife and I. That's got a lot to do with. While we started supporting Tyler and what he's doing down there.
Right. Yeah, he's a great man. He's an amazing person.
I'm
lucky to know him.
I feel the same way, man. He is referring to my own son, although my sons are older than him. But and he's too old to be called a grandchild, though, so well, I'm going to call him that. I'm just and when you learn his story about, and not to make this Tyler story because it's already been on here twice, but at his age, when he got started and realized this was his calling in life, and where he is 10 years later, just going strong. And, you know, now his life's in jeopardy because he's helping other people.
Yeah.
That ticks me off. Well, tell us about your first case in Arkansas. Once you got trained up, and do you remember back then, your first successful case?
I do. Yeah. Matter of fact, it was in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Just a CSAM case. So there's law enforcement software that monitors certain networks. You can monitor certain file sharing networks and see if there's anybody connected to the network in the state and they possess any illegal CSAM. CSAM is again, a term that we've kind of used to replace child pornography. And this law enforcement tool allows us to detect if anybody in the state is currently in possession of that and looking to trade it or distribute it. And that was my first case. So I was going into it as just a possession case. It's somebody that's looking at or acquiring CSAM and then distributing it, exchanging it for other CSAM. And I learned really quickly that that's very rarely the case. Most of the time, in my experience, over 80% of the time, those people that are collectors are also abusers. I mean, they're collecting that and they're viewing it because that's what interests them, right? And so that first offense, I went there, we knocked on the door, served a search warrant, seized all the computers, seized the camera, took photos of the house. And it was, again, just a CSAM possession case. Took that camera to our digital forensics lab, looked at what was on the micro SD card, did a forensic examination, which allows us to identify deleted images, and found several deleted images of a young boy in the home being sexually abused. So we had to go back to that house a couple weeks later, rearrest the offender, and then kind of start canvassing the neighborhood. All we could see of the boy, couldn't see his face. You could see from the neck down. In one of them, you could see he was wearing tennis shoes, very old tennis shoes. But that's all we really had. So we went back to that neighborhood 2 weeks after the first arrest, door to door, looking at, okay, here's a house with a basketball hoop or some bikes in the front yard. They must have children. Let's go over there and show them the shoe. And the first house we went to, which was directly across the street from the offender, I showed the mom the shoe, instantly started crying, ran in the house, came running out with the shoe. She said, "That's my son." And at the time, the son was 15. The abuse started when he was 12. He was mowing the lawn for the offender, and the offender just groomed him and had been abusing him for several years.
Did the mom have any idea that something like that was going on?
Clueless, absolutely clueless. No idea. That was my first case. And I was hooked because these are seemingly innocent people, right? Like if you see somebody addicted to meth or somebody that's strung out on heroin, when you see them, it's obviously apparent that they're going through something, right? This is potential of danger. These types of cases, it's anybody. I've arrested firemen. I've arrested policemen. I've arrested judges, professors, homeless people, rich people, old people. My youngest offender was 12 years old. My oldest was 72 years old. I mean, it's on all aspects or on all spectrums. And so that's why it was always just a real challenge for me. Again, that was my first case. And at that point, that's when I really got into forensics because I didn't do the forensic examination. But when we found those images on that camera, that's when I started getting my training on digital forensics, just because it's going to make the investigation, so much more thorough.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question, but don't incriminate yourself here.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure statute of limitations might run out.
Yeah.
When you go to arrest somebody like that, I'm not sure that I could hold my temper on how I would deal with that perverted piece of scum. I guess the good Lord gives all of us abilities, and that's not one of my abilities. How do you handle that?
It's tough. I hate them just like everybody else. And I've always been very careful. Later on in my career, I had an experience where we were arrested a really bad offender, one of the most evil people I'd ever dealt with. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be kind of a surprise arrest. He was coming to what he thought was pick up another child. He was going to get arrested. And I had members of our SWAT team at the time accompany me on that arrest because he had some criminal history, some criminal violence in his past. And we wanted to make sure we had our tactical team there. And they did what tactical teams do, right? He resisted and he was met with a sufficient amount of force, but he got roughed up quite a bit, deservedly. And I tried to interview him afterwards, and he was so pissed off about that he wouldn't talk to me. And I needed him to talk to me. I needed his passcode to his phone, some passwords and things to make my life a lot easier on the forensic side. So I learned very quickly that even though I'd love to just punch him in the face or do a rifle butt run to the nose, it's better to wait, make that go as smoothly as possible. And then when I get my up years is at court, when they get 350 years, they're in prison for the rest of their life. And we've had some sentences in Arkansas courts that were that high, up into the 320 year sentences. So that's when I break it off in them.
Yep. Wow. I'm getting amped up here just listening to you talk about stories. This is cool. In my law enforcement career, I was in a lot of shootings and they didn't bother me. The only time it ever bothered me was when my partner was shot
he survived. Their informant was killed. But that one bothered me because it was my partner, I think. I know a lot of people can't deal with shootings. You know, I know cops that get in their first shooting, they quit. They've had enough. So it just takes a special person. And it sounds like the good Lord gave you the ability to deal with this so that you can protect the innocent, which is exactly what we need. You don't need some jackass like me out there with a hot temper that's going to blow the case.
Right.
They can think it through logically and get the evidence in order, make sure all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted, and put these son of bitches away for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, because a lot of these guys, like we mentioned, are successful people, seemingly normal, successful people. So a lot of times they have a lot to lose. So they're hiring defense attorneys and they're hiring experts and they're going to contest any evidence that you have. So it has to be done right. I think it's easier, like presenting digital forensic evidence in court. I mean, it's technology and it's fact. Like, this is how I found it. And, you know, it's almost indisputable. In court, what are they going to dispute? They're going to look at the human error. They're going to make sure I'm certified that the software's licensed. They're technical cases, and most of the time they go to court because they're not getting a plea bargain. Nobody wants to plea bargain with a pedophile, and then they have a lot to lose, so they're going to go to court. So it has to be done properly.
God bless you, man. My hat's off to you for what you're doing here. We've been going quite a while now, there's so many more questions I got for you, and more stories we want to hear from you, but. We're going to call an end here to part one. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for part one. You got to come back and listen to part two tomorrow. We're going to get into more things that Chad's involved with and what he's doing now to protect not only us here in the United States, but other parts of the world. This is just a devastating issue that none of us can afford to overlook. We're all busy in life, but is there anything more important than our children or our grandchildren? And we know there's not. I'm giving you a question that you can't answer any other way. So thank you for joining us here today on The Game of Crimes, and we look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Hey, players, that's the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, just a reminder that Game of Crimes is now posting interview videos on YouTube. You can find those at Game of Crimes Podcast. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes, our guests, book lists, merchandise, and more. And for more content, join us on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. I have several monthly episodes that range from silly to serious, so come on over and join the fun. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. I'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Casino. Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.